Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, data center development is booming, but so is skepticism of the facilities and what they mean for energy and water use. There is a growing movement against data centers, while governments are considering regulations. We'll have a report. This week marked the 150th anniversary of the novel Tom Sawyer being published. Mark Twain's hometown, which served as the setting for the book, celebrated. We discuss Twain's famous work and why it remains relevant today. International students say their lives have been made harder by some of the Trump administration changes. We'll have more on what that could mean for higher education in the U.S. An Illinois-based insurance company is making big changes to benefits offered to its agents. We have more on that. And this week in Illinois history remembers a major food breakthrough, the invention of processed cheese. That and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Analysis from Pew Research Center finds the number of data centers in Illinois is set to nearly double. Development of large-scale data centers is booming across the Midwest and the South, but water and energy usage are rallying some communities against data centers. As Abigail Botar reports, local and state governments are rushing to regulate the growing industry.
More than 100 people packed into tight chambers for an Illinois County board meeting in April.
I'm going to call this meeting of the Champaign County Board to order.
They're here to support pressing pause on development of large-scale data centers, a move many communities have made in recent months. Dozens of people voiced concerns about the massive amounts of water and energy data centers use, including sixth grader Samuel Tamori.
We don't need the AI as we need our water.
The board unanimously passed the one-year moratorium. These debates surrounding data centers are playing out in communities across the Midwest and Great Plains. Concerns from environmental impacts to noise are spurring efforts to block the new development. In Missouri, one St. Louis suburb even voted out half of its city council after it approved a $6 billion data center deal. Newly elected Festus Councilmember Rick Belleville says he decided to run for office to bring more transparency to the project.
When somebody comes to town and says, hey, we're going to give you millions of dollars, and we're going to build a data center, they need to slow down and get a full understanding of how the whole thing's going to affect their community.
Now he's working to put limits on water use for any new industry, including data centers, that want to come to Festus. It's not just local governments. State lawmakers are also pondering how to regulate data centers. Legislators in more than 20 states, including Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, Minnesota, and Oklahoma, introduced bills this year to add guardrails to data center development.
I think people are trying to catch up.
That's Dave Owen, a law professor at the University of California, San Francisco, who studies the energy impacts of data centers. He says this flurry of legislation stems from the outrage many communities feel when data center developers try to build in their backyard.
I don't think really anybody foresaw how much of a popular backlash there would be against data centers. So even a year and a half ago, a lot of state and local governments were very eagerly trying to court data centers.
Analysis from the National Conference of State Legislatures found as of May, 38 states currently offered dedicated incentives meant to attract data centers. But several states are reconsidering. Illinois is one of them. Governor J.B. Pritzker praised the passage of tax incentives in 2019, but at his State of the State speech this year, he sang a different tune.
In the face of rising demand and surging prices, I'm proposing a two-year pause on authorization of new data center tax credits.
After the Illinois legislature failed to act, Pritzker announced he's implementing a tax incentive pause starting July 1st. Several other states, including Michigan, are considering a full repeal of their data center incentives, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. Michigan's tax incentives for data centers went into effect just last year. State Representative Dylan Wigella, a Democrat, is sponsoring legislation to repeal them, and it's co-sponsored by a Republican.
As people especially have started to see the bipartisan local pushback, a lot of legislators have changed their mind on this.
But Michigan's governor still supports data centers. That's one reason Wigella doesn't think his bills will pass, but he hopes communities will take up the effort and pass their own restrictions. That's a heavy weight for individual communities to bear, according to Jonathan Coppice. He's the director of the Gardner Agriculture Policy Program at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
This isn't fair to put on a county board.
He says the federal government should step in.
But I do think it's a really difficult thing even for states. Water flows, electricity flows across state lines.
Federal legislation to pause data center development has been introduced, but the bill, sponsored by minority party members, is unlikely to pass in a Republican-controlled Congress. That means for now, these decisions about water, energy, and large-scale development will continue to be a patchwork of local and state laws. I'm Abigail Botar, Harvest Public Media.
Millions of immigrants apply for asylum in the U.S. every year, which protects them from deportation, but judges often deny those applications. Reporting for the Midwest Newsroom from Kansas City, Salisa Kalakal reports on what those long odds mean for one asylum-seeking family.
Ever since the Trump administration ended the humanitarian parole program for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans last year, this mother of four living in Cass County has been stressed. The Costa Rican woman, who is a native of Nicaragua, spends most days at home because she's nervous about getting detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Aquí las leyes migratorias hoy es una cosa, mañana es otra cosa.
To be truthful, I haven't been able to sleep well.
The Midwest Newsroom is not using her name because she fears deportation. But in March, she told me through an interpreter that she faces violence back in Costa Rica. The family immigrated in 2024 after the mother testified against a family member who was selling drugs.
My plans were not to come here.
Pero sí dije.
First, they spent some time in Costa Rican witness protection. Then they connected with a sponsor to get to Kansas City.
Es un país muy lejos. Este hombre no me va a buscar allá.
But I did say, well, this country is very far, and I don't think these people are going to find me there.
Entonces yo me sentí segura venirme para acá.
So I felt myself safe coming here.
After years of trying to protect her family, she still remembers how happy she was when she got official approval to come to the U.S.
Even walking in the street, I could feel, I was laughing in the street and feeling the wind in my face and smiling. So I called my mom very happy and I told her, Mom, guess what? I already received the formal invitation to go to the U.S.
But now, without any legal protections, she's hanging her hopes on asylum. It means she must prove to a judge her family suffered persecution in Costa Rica, and they have a well-founded fear of harm if they return.
And I'm also afraid because I know that if I go back to my country, again, I'm going to be in danger.
So far, this mom and her family have spent thousands of dollars and filled out countless applications to work and stay here legally. Eventually, their case could be heard by one of four immigration judges in Kansas City who cover both Kansas and Missouri. Their backlog included more than 50,000 cases through March, and the Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse shows these judges have denied 95% of asylum cases so far in 2026.
It is clearer now than it has ever been before that the administration is doing everything it can to make asylum completely inaccessible to the majority of the world.
Immigration attorney Ginevra Alberti isn't involved in the mother of four's case, but she says asylum seekers often wait years for a decision, and the Trump administration has cracked down on who gets asylum.
It's just been kind of from all sides, they're doing everything possible to dismantle the system. And then all of a sudden, the rug is being swept out from under them.
Alberti says key decisions can sometimes come down to a judge's own discretion. It's not enough for someone to say they fear persecution back home. They also have to prove it.
You're dealing with people who are traumatized, for the most part, and who may have memory issues because of that, and you're holding them to this incredibly high standard of having perfect memory, which none of us have.
Even routine immigration meetings have become anxious for the Cass County mother. For her youngest son's recent appointment at the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services office, she asked a family friend to come with her. And while everything went according to plan that day, she can't help but think of the difference asylum would make for her family.
Sentiría paz.
I will feel peace.
Sentiría confianza, tranquilidad.
I will feel calmed.
But until she gets her day in front of a judge, she's on edge. For the Midwest Newsroom, I'm Salisa Kalakal in Kansas City.
International students say the Trump administration has made their lives harder in the past year. We've heard that from those on several campuses. Peter Medlin checked in with some of the students at Northern Illinois University.
Studying in the United States used to be a no-brainer for Indian students like Rian. He just graduated from NIU with a master's degree. Good universities, bright job prospects, whether you wanted to work in the U.S. after graduation or take your talents back home.
But now I think everyone is thinking a lot about what their options are and where they can go, because a lot of students in my back home are considering Europe, they're considering China.
Rian wanted to use just his first name out of fear the administration could target his visa. International student enrollment in the U.S. is down 20% this spring compared to last, and NIU's international enrollment is down nearly 30% since Trump's election in 2024. And since the president retook office, Stephanie Brown says constant rule changes have led to a sense of uncertainty and anxiety for students. She's the director of International Student and Scholar Services at NIU.
I've been doing this work for 14 years, and this is not something that I've ever had to navigate.
The Trump administration revoked more than 8,000 student visas last year, including several at NIU that were later reinstated. A third-year PhD student spoke to us anonymously, nervous their visa could be threatened for speaking out. We'll call him Fareed.
It was difficult from a long time ago for some citizens of some specific countries, but now it has become difficult for mostly all the international students, actually.
Of course, it is still more challenging for students from particular countries. Late last year, the president effectively banned visas for students from 39 countries, and that included Nigeria, one of the top 10 nations sending students to the U.S. And Stephanie Brown says because of those country-specific impacts, her office is doing more individual advising than ever.
Because there's so many caveats in place, it's much harder to do group sessions on different topics.
More visas are now subject to additional review called administrative processing, and Brown says some students can't get their visas in time, so her team works with them to start programs virtually or defer admission. And students already in the U.S. are having their visas continuously vetted. And Rian, the student from India, is currently applying for optional practical training, which allows students to work temporarily in the U.S. after graduation for 12 months with an extension for STEM fields. And he says that process is also taking longer.
2 years ago was around 2 to 3 months. And now I've applied my OPT back in December and I still didn't get it. And I'm still waiting on it.
The longer he waits, the less he can actually use OPT and the fewer opportunities available. And for Reed, the PhD student says that research funding cuts and work restrictions make it harder and harder for international students to find jobs.
A highly qualified international student coming over here, completing his PhD, he just wants to have a postdoc, go back to his country. Even in that ideal scenario, he is not getting the opportunity.
He says he doesn't believe that students like him are competing with or taking jobs away from local students.
It will backfire in probably maybe 5-10 years along the way.
He says it'll diminish university research and that enrollment will continue falling. International student tuition is nearly 3 times higher than in-state tuition, so schools will have fewer resources without them. And Brown says her international office always has to scan the horizon for the next big change.
What we're looking ahead to is the proposed changes to the duration of status rule, which allows international students to be here for the duration of their academic program.
The new rule would limit students to 4 years before they have to renew, which he says could be especially complicated for PhD programs that often take 6 or 7 years. And Rian says all of this weighs on students, especially since many of them have been away from their family for years. So when it starts to feel like the country doesn't want you, at some point they start questioning if it's worth it.
It just looks like they're doing everything they can to make lives difficult for international students, and I hope it would stop soon.
He says the U.S. built trust over decades, but now it's broken. And even with a new administration or new rules, it would take a long time to repair, especially since there are other options now. And Brown says the number of international applications has dropped, but where it's really dropped is visa issuance, students actually getting to the U.S. But if student interest starts plummeting, then enrollment could tumble further. Right now, they're focused on helping the students who are still interested.
The U.S.'s higher education infrastructure is strong, and so my sincerest hope is that the interest will bounce back faster than maybe we think it will.
But the increased burden and anxiety those students are feeling is certainly not helping. I'm Peter Medlin.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargow. This week's slice of history is a uniquely American invention, processed cheese. The United States patent for processed cheese was issued to James L. Kraft on June 6, 1916. Kraft grew up on a farm in Ontario, Canada, where he and his brothers developed a business delivering dairy products. He moved to Chicago in 1903 with only a few dollars in his pocket, rented a horse and wagon, and started a cheese delivery service. He'd buy wholesale and deliver to stores around the city. As his business grew, Kraft brought in his brothers and built a cheese manufacturing plant in Stockton, Illinois, in the northwest corner of the state. But cheese went bad, really fast, especially in the summer. Kraft hypothesized this was caused by the same bacteria that produced the cheese in the first place. He experimented with different heating techniques to destroy the bacteria, but preserve the cheesy flavor and consistency. He perfected the process in 1914 and patented it in 1916. Kraft's processed cheese could be packed into round cans or rectangular tins for easy shipping and storage. Because of its long shelf life, the U.S. government purchased 5 million pounds of it to feed soldiers during World War I. Even though the cheese industry condemned Kraft's creation as an abomination, by 1930, 40% of all cheese consumed in the United States was made by Kraft. I'm Clint Cargow, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has released data showing emergency room visits for tick bites are up. Weekly visit rates have not been this high since 2017. Teresa Steckler is an extension specialist at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She says ticks are extra dense in suburban areas surrounded by woods where deer live.
Ticks are, I would believe, overwintering on certain animals like deer and others. So it's just a perfect storm of the ticks being able to survive and thrive right now.
Steckler says even if your pets are treated for ticks, it's important to check their fur thoroughly when they come inside. She suggests visiting the Illinois Department of Public Health's tick website, which has been recently updated to include safety recommendations and maps of where tick-borne diseases have been identified across the state. Just ahead, we'll celebrate a great American novel based right here in the Midwest. That's on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. 150 years ago this week, the great American novel Tom Sawyer was published. Elaine Shaw brings us more in a conversation with Mark Schneider, development and marketing manager for the Mark Twain Boyhood Home and Museum in Twain's hometown of Hannibal, Missouri.
So, Mark, let's talk about Mark Twain. He was born Samuel Langhorn Clemens in 1835 in Hannibal, Missouri, and he would later live in St. Louis and then travel across the world as Mark Twain. Tell us a bit, Mark, about his upbringing in Hannibal about 30 years before the Civil War.
Yeah, so Samuel Clemens was actually born in Florida, Missouri, which is about 45 minutes away from Hannibal in Monroe County, Missouri. There is still the birthplace shrine there in Florida, so you can actually go and see the cabin in which Samuel Clemens was born in. They moved to Hannibal when Samuel was about four. His father, John Clemens, was a man that really wanted to be a businessman. And so they moved to Hannibal with the hopes that Samuel's father would open up a dry goods store, a general store, and be successful in running that general store. And so Samuel lived in Hannibal from about the ages of 4 to 17 before he would leave to go work as a typesetter in newspapers all the way from St. Louis up to Keokuk, Iowa. He is a product of Missouri, especially from that early to mid 1800s, and then obviously growing and learning throughout the late 1800s and the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. And so right here in your own backyard, you have the father of American literature that, cut his teeth, so to say, here in Northeast Missouri.
Mark, what are some of the details of Samuel Langhorne Clemens' childhood that ended up in his books?
If you read Mark Twain's works all the way from celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County all the way through. He really does put a lot of personal experience into a lot of his writings. And The Adventures of Tom Sawyer is set in a fictional town called St. Petersburg. Mark Twain specifically came out and said that St. Petersburg, the inspiration for St. Petersburg, is Hannibal, Missouri. And then all of the characters in that town of St. Petersburg or Hannibal, Missouri, were all inspired by friends and children that he grew up with and the adventures that they have. His influence and his experience here in Hannibal and in Missouri as a young person really influenced his work throughout his time as an author.
Now, I understand, Mark, that you have been working with the Mark Twain Boyhood Home and Museum for a little under a year and 4 months. As you have experienced that, I mean, have you picked up on some details that exist even now that do appear in Mark Twain's writings?
Obviously, when he's talking about The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, when you stand in Hannibal, Missouri, you can literally look up and see Cardiff Hill. When he talks about going up on the hill to go play Robin Hood and Knights in Shining Armor, you can literally look up and see the hill. You can look out onto the river, which is only 2 or 3 blocks away from his front door of his boyhood home, and you can see the island that he talks about going to with his friends for 3 days when they, when the people of the town believed them to be dead, that they had drowned in the river. And so that's how Tom and Huck came to attend their own funeral. Mm-hmm. There's so many things here that obviously influenced him. Now, those are the physical things. Beyond that, his father was the Justice of the Peace in this area. So Samuel Clemens was able to see a lot of things up close and personal. He fell asleep in his father's office one night, late at night, after not getting home in time. He didn't want to suffer a beating from his father, so he went to his father's law office and fell asleep on the couch, only to wake up with the thought of a presence in the room to realize that there was a dead body on the floor. Samuel Clemens would often see these things and see that justice wasn't exactly what it was spelled out to be. Crimes against black people would go unpunished, like murder and things of that nature. And so he really did see a lot, even through his experiences, that stuck with him.
And as you mentioned that, Mark, racism and slavery are clearly represented in the books Twain wrote and in Twain's other writings. How did those things present themselves in Hannibal of his childhood pre-Civil War?
Obviously, he had grown up in, was born and grew up in a southern state. Even with its position in the country, Missouri was considered a southern state because Missouri was largely, and especially this area, was largely settled by people from southern states. So they came to Missouri for cheap land. And so they brought with them when they moved to this area, when they started to settle this area, they brought with them antebellum culture. Mm-hmm. They also brought with them the institution of slavery. That's kind of how it made it to where it was in Missouri. Now, Missouri obviously being surrounded by bordering states that were considered, that are north, northern states, Illinois and Iowa, this was a very bad place to be during the Civil War. Missouri was a bloody, bloody state during the Civil War. And especially a place like Northeast Missouri, where you can literally look across the Mississippi and see Illinois. I mean, you had neighbors living next to each other that obviously found disagreements over a lot of things, but especially the topic of slavery. Samuel Clemens saw slavery very, very early on. He often talked about later on in life that, you know, only a few blocks from his front door, he saw a group of black individuals, men and women, that were obviously enslaved. They were chained to each other, and they were literally waiting to be sold downriver. Mm-hmm. And he said that those are the saddest faces he had ever seen in his life. And so that obviously stuck with him.
When we get to The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, we're not seeing some of what you have described. The book is a book that was meant for younger readers, as I understand it. And it was 150 years ago tomorrow that this book was published, and that was on June 9th, 1876. Was the book an instant success?
It was fairly successful. I wouldn't say it was a large commercial success upon its release. It really didn't become largely commercially successful until Huckleberry Finn was published almost 7 or 8 years later. And so, 9 years later, excuse me, he started writing Huckleberry Finn. He picked it up about 7 years after Tom Sawyer was published. So Tom Sawyer, it's a bit of an outlier for Mark Twain, the book, as far as what he wrote. Mark Twain wrote for many different age groups. Pudd'nhead Wilson was written for young adults, teens, people in high school. Tom Sawyer was written for children, adolescents. It's the story of adolescence, and so that's why it's very relatable. He also wrote other books, Innocence Abroad, Life on the Mississippi, Roughing It. These are things that are meant for adults to read. Huck Finn was meant for young adults as well. You're looking at probably mid to late teens, early 20s. That's really what it's meant for. But he really wrote for a large audience. He wrote for everyone. Mark Twain was a humorist above all. Mark Twain saw the funny in life, and even difficult situations and things that he didn't think was right, he would often try to find the humor in it, not only to try to deal with it himself, but to also to draw attention to it. Whereas The Adventures of Tom Sawyer removes a lot of his more satirical writing, his more kind of pointed making fun of that he would be very, very good at and would be known for throughout his life. He really backed that off and wrote really a story, a bunch of smaller short stories that he compiled from his childhood into essentially a cohesive story focusing on one main character in Tom Sawyer. Mm-hmm. And so it really was kind of a departure for him from his normal writings of the time. But it was meant for kids to read, kids to enjoy, and hopefully learn a little something.
We've been talking today about Missouri native Mark Twain and his novel, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. It was published 150 years ago this week in 1876. Mark, we had talked a bit about Huckleberry Finn, and that is the book of his adventures that came out after Tom Sawyer's. And Huckleberry Finn was received with great acclaim. You don't consider it a sequel. Can you put a finer point on why that's the case?
Whereas it does refer to Tom Sawyer and those things, Tom Sawyer was narrated by Mark Twain. So the book, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, was written in proper English. It was narrated as such. It was narrated from a different point of view. And when you get into Huck Finn, one of the very first things that is said, as a matter of fact, it's the first thing that's written down as The Adventures of Huck Finn, is you might not heard about me having you lesson. You read the book, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, written by a man named Mark Twain. He told the truth mainly. He stretched it some, but he told the truth mainly. So those might not be the exact words, but it's pretty close. So he introduces himself right off the bat as the person that's going to narrate this story. That story was written in the vernacular, the common dialect. This was the way people spoke in Hannibal, Missouri during Mark Twain's childhood, during Samuel Clemens' childhood. He really is addressing in a different way right off the bat the story of a boy that, I don't like using the word redemption in this cause, but he is fighting for that realization of what's good, what's bad? How are my actions reflective of who I am and what I believe? It really was a change of pace from The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. Now, technically, if you want to consider it a sequel, that's fine.
There's a point that you had made about good and bad, and I think that is a great segue to talking about language. And for as long as The Adventures of Tom Sawyer has been in print, people have debated the terms used for its Black and Native American characters. I'm talking specifically about the N-word and a word that sounds like Indian. Now, the use of these words was controversial even in Mark Twain's time. How did he explain their employment, their use?
Tom Sawyer was written about a time period, 30 to 40 years before the Civil War. It was published 11 years after the Civil War during America's centennial. It's an interesting time period where he's writing about a divided nation. It's published during a time of reunification that was still very, very iffy. And so to describe the life of a Southern boy in a Southern state at that time, I mean, he was going out on a limb to do so. And again, it wasn't initially a huge commercial success, although he obviously sold copies. I would say that he used those words for a desired effect. Mark Twain was all about image. He was a highly polished image, the white suit, the cigar. And so he was a very well thought out person. And so in these stories, when he uses racial slurs, he's using them for a reason. It's quoted by quite a few Twain scholars and quite a few people that like Twain that nobody else could have written these stories the way that he did. It takes a Southern perspective. He used those slurs on purpose. The reason that he used those slurs is, one, to make sure that you understand the setting of the story and where they are and the time that they are in. And two, to make sure to get your attention. He knew what he was doing using those words, and he made sure to use those words on purpose. Mm-hmm. We don't have a use for those words on our campus now around here. You won't find many of those words. You won't find them across our signage and things of that nature, because it's not our purpose for using those words. We don't have those purposes now in our setting, but as part of our mission to promote awareness and appreciation of his life and works, and to demonstrate the relevance of his stories and ideas, you know, we do feel it's important that it is seen that these words were used on purpose to elicit reaction and discussion.
This anniversary of the publication of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, it comes at the same time that people in the U.S. are observing another milestone, and that's the 250th birthday of the country. Mark Twain is arguably the most famous American author ever. What connections do you see, you know, considering these two anniversaries?
He is the father of American literature. Hemingway said that when Huck Finn came out, with Huck Finn narrating and using the vernacular and the common dialect, that was the start of American literature. And so you're going to see a lot of things that you can compare to his works and the progression of our country. Our country is only 250 years old. It's not that old when you're talking about a nation. So if you think about, the book was released during the centennial celebration 150 years ago. That was very much the adolescence period of the United States. And The Adventures of Tom Sawyer is the story of adolescence, about going on adventures. It's about realizing who your friends are and kind of discovering new things that you're interested in and really trying to grow up. A lot of similarities to the progression of our country. It's been relevant for 150 years. It's never been out of print, and people still pick it up across the country, whether it's a child or an adult today, to read it. I think that everyone can relate to the childhood adventures of going out with friends and playing games and going around and causing a little bit of mischief and being curious about what's behind that next door and things like that. And those are all themes that are addressed in Tom Sawyer. It's still relevant because people can still relate to those experiences, and it reminds you of your own childhood.
Mark Schneider is development and marketing manager for the Mark Twain Boyhood Home and Museum in Twain's hometown of Hannibal, Missouri. This week marked 150 years since Tom Sawyer was published. Hannibal had numerous events to mark the occasion.
The day's Tom Sawyer, he gets high on you. When the space he invades, he gets by on you.
More to come on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. While most student research projects end up in a storage bin in the attic, one that some eighth graders at Naperville's Lincoln Junior High worked on is now state law. Jess Savage has the story.
Naperville students spearheaded the effort to make the big, fuzzy, black and gold bumblebee the official Illinois state bee. Barb Bell is a science teacher. She designed a research project for their eighth grade class, where they worked together, making a case for one of the 10 most common bee species found in Illinois.
Whenever we can make learning more hands-on, it absolutely makes it more meaningful for students. And so the fact that this was more experiential than anything is the greatest teacher ever.
Students worked in small groups to do a deep dive on one bee species. Liza DeSanto knew exactly which bee she wanted to advocate for.
When we picked out our bees, I ran to the front of the line so I could get the black and gold bumblebee yeah. first. I was like, yeah. I need the black and gold bumblebee. So yeah, we ran in the front and we're like, black and gold bumblebee.
Liza, Ahana Patel, and Sophia Nicoloudis were project partners from the beginning. They designed and narrated presentations which were shared with schools all across Illinois. Thousands of students all had a chance to choose the state bee. The black and gold bumblebee came out on top. Black and gold bumblebees are native to North America. They build above-ground nests in grassland landscapes like prairies. Elena Groton is with the Dolezal Bee Research Lab at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She says they're especially great pollinators for agricultural plants.
When they get on a flower, they shake it. It's called sonicating, and they buzz really loudly, and then they shake out all of the pollen. Plants like tomatoes or peppers or blueberries all really benefit from this type of pollination.
She says their fuzziness has a lot to do with how well they pollinate.
They just get like completely head to toe covered in pollen, and they've got so much hair all over them that it just sticks. And so they go to the next flower, and they just roll around again.
Black and gold bumblebees aren't a species of conservation concern in Illinois. But because they look so similar to the very common American bumblebee, Groton says it's hard to collect good population data about this species. And with the student voting complete, it was time for Sophia, Ahana, and Liza to present their research at the Capitol. They testified for naming the black and gold bumblebee as the Illinois State Bee.
I was really not that nervous.
I was a little nervous.
Once we got in there, I wasn't nervous.
I wasn't nervous just because we prepared so much.
State Representative Janet Rohr introduced the bill to legislators. She supported the students through the process and got to meet them in person on the day they came to testify.
You know, when you shine a light on these areas, that attention, I think, is so important. To helping, you know, all of us know what are the things that we can do to turn the tide.
Ahana says it's special to create change, especially when it comes to our natural world.
We all, like me, Sophia, Liza, we all really like care about nature. Like we live in like a really foresty area, and that's like a high priority in the state we live in as well. So us getting to make an impact on that, like in lawmaking, was like a really like exciting, like, decision, yeah.
Many students experienced a change of heart about bees throughout the research project, including Sophia.
I just thought bees were an insect that stings you, but after doing all this information, I really actually understood how much impact it has on our environment and how much it really does for the Midwest and basically the whole world and how much it really helps.
The bill passed in the Senate over the weekend, making the big fuzzy bug Illinois' state bee. I'm Jess Savage.
As Route 66 turns 100, a new book is expanding the story of the Mother Road by focusing on people often left out of its history. The Illinois author and Route 66 historian Cheryl Eichard-Jett's latest book, Aprons Away, Women's Work on Route 66, documents the roles women have played along the highway's more than 2,400-mile stretch from Chicago to Los Angeles over the past century. Jett spoke with Lauren Warnicki and said the idea for the book about women's roles on the highway grew out of a pattern she noticed while researching and traveling the famous highway.
I've gotten to know so many people who are just top preservationists and authors and cartographers, and it's mind-blowing to think of the work that they have done, and so many of them have devoted a much bigger part of their lives to Route 66 even than I have. And to see the culmination of all that work for so many people and organizations is very satisfying.
Well, what has been the early
reception? Obviously, we're still in the early days of launching the book and being able to talk to people about it, but what initial reactions have you received about it?
There seems to be a lot of interest and a lot of excitement, particularly from women Route 66 fans and women who are not necessarily associated with Route 66. I think that's probably not surprising.
Yeah.
Because partially we're at a time, again, it sort of goes in cycles when women's rights are more in the news or more in the forefront. And we're in that cycle, in that period of time again. So I think for women in general to be able to look back and see what some of these women accomplished in a time when they faced a lot of gender discrimination. They were trying to go to work or go to university in male only, you know, the policy was male only.
It's kind of a paradox because we have this wonderful centennial for Route 66. We have the 250th anniversary of our country. So there's a lot of reasons to celebrate, but also there's a war going on and there's a lot of political divide in the country. People are sad and angry and despondent. And so I wonder what we can learn from the past, from your book, from these stories of, you know, hope and Americana.
Route 66, in its 100 years of history, has covered some very difficult times in the United States before. The 1920s, of course, we think of the Roaring Twenties and the push to advertise and promote U.S. Highway 66, but it wasn't all just great in the Roaring Twenties as well. Then the 1930s, marked by the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl immigrants in particular, because they traveled along Route 66 to what they hoped would be the golden state of California. It didn't always turn out that way. And then, of course, the stress and the loss of World War II in the 40s. So my point would be that we have gone through some very difficult times as a country, as a gender, as women previously. Somehow we have muddled through.
Author and Route 66 historian Cheryl Eichardt-Jett, whose new book, Aprons Away, Women's Work on Route 66, is now available. State Farm has told its 19,000 agents that it's making significant changes to the compensation and benefits package for them. Several agents say this will substantially reduce their earnings. The Bloomington-based insurer is also making changes for retired agents. Charlie Schlinker fills us in.
State Farm agents are independent contractors. They operate under three different contracts. The company doesn't change contracts all that often. The most recent version came out in 2005, before that, 1997, and one even older than that, mainly for probably soon-to-retire agents. All three contracts are being terminated, and State Farm is moving to a single style of contract.
Well, what will the effects be on those agents?
It depends on how long you've been an agent. Some agents have said the cut to their base compensation is 35 to 40%. State Farm has called that speculation. Agents have told WGLT it's not speculation at all. It's derived from a calculator the company provided. Younger agents say they will lose about 15% of the commission, mid-career agents more, and the most senior agents are up there in that higher range.
Is it totally certain it may be that much?
The company does have targets and performance metrics. The agents we talked with said they might be able to make it back to break even if they hit every performance metric. That's unclear because State Farm hasn't given out details of what meeting the targets means. What the change amounts to, the agents say, is a shift from compensation based on retention and service of customers to one based on new sales. The company, by the way, calls that characterization fair.
Okay, maybe fair, but what's the actual impact?
It's widely expected some agents are going to retire. Newer agents may also look at the terms of the new deal and decide they can do better elsewhere and leave. Courtney Weaver of the Insurance Buzz podcast says that frees up chunks of their books of business for company reassignment.
So if you stay, there is opportunity. There is opportunity to expand. You will have bigger books of business. You'll have to grow in different ways.
Is this just State Farm or is it happening elsewhere?
Michael Weaver, also of the Insurance Buzz podcast, says the Bloomington-based insurance giant is not unique.
Across the board, carriers are cutting commissions. They're cutting bonus plans. They're cutting variable comp.
Okay, so that's on the agent side. How will that change the customer experience?
It depends on who you talk to. State Farm says the changes coupled with AI, new technology, a strategy called Digital Plus People will make its service even better than it is now. The company, quote, is, "These changes enable agents to grow and help more customers," unquote. President and CEO John Farney said last month the State Farm is focusing on becoming a next-gen good neighbor, a State Farm that is faster and tech-enabled while staying true to its mission and values. Farney says, as we modernize, we're doing it with the clear principle that technology should strengthen human connection, not substitute for it, unquote. Agents aren't so sure. If their goal is sales, 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 they say they won't have time to serve clients directly. One mid-sized agent says, okay, he'll have to hire someone new to do the service while he concentrates on sales, and that will just about be a wash on the income side. He says he was already having trouble meeting payroll. A couple agents highlight the point that geography matters. If you are in an area with a decent population base, you can probably get more clients. If you are in a rural area where there aren't too many people, you'll have to try something different. A longtime agent in a small town tells us, she may have to do digital marketing statewide to come back to an equivalent income. She won't like it, but she'll do it. What she and the other agent both say is that the shift in the way they will have to do business will undercut the whole good neighbor vibe State Farm has relied on for decades, because increasingly, customers will not be neighbors.
What happens if an agent doesn't want to accept the new contract?
A retired agent says State Farm has made buyout offers to agents. The window to accept or decline the buyout, June 1 through September 30. State Farm, by the way, resists the term buyout. The company says agents that do not want to sign the new contract can apply for a benefit that may be provided. Agents kind of snort and say, yes, it's a buyout, but it's a, quote, Hunger Games buyout. You apply, there's a limited pool for payments, first come, first served. The payments are the size of what one agent said starts at 10% of the value of his book of business, and even the upper end of the potential payment scales is an amount that that agent called insulting.
And is that all State Farm is doing? What about the benefits?
Now we get to the part of the changes that are angering agents the most. The company will no longer offer health insurance to agents and spouses. That's according to a letter sent to agents and retired agents. State Farm says, quote, the complexities and changing nature of the health insurance market and associated regulations make it exceptionally challenging to provide independent contractors with a modern benefits offering. The company says it's providing resources to agents to help find coverage elsewhere. Some agents say they have pressing medical needs. They face open market prices for health coverage that are double what State Farm offered them in what was already what they called a high deductible plan. Here's a quote. Pulling health care out from under our feet is a bit hypocritical to me. We're the biggest insurance company in the world, yet you're not offering health insurance to your loyal agency base. They say they resent executives. They feel they look down on agents distantly from the heights. Another quote. Furthermore, the hypocrisy is all of the executives of State Farm are State Farm employees who will still get health insurance benefits. So a mid-career agent says it's a bitter irony for agents who sell life insurance because potential customers for life insurance often say, eh, I have it at work. Agents always tell those people you can't rely on what you have at work. That can change at any time. Now they have a firsthand experience.
Well, it sounds like they're angry, Charlie.
One of the words they're using is betrayed, false promises, broken faith. Those are also direct quotes. Several agents say the health insurance and the end of payments under what's called the annual investment payment program are the biggest things to them. The changes in commissions they can stomach. They're capitalists, too. They don't like it, but they can deal. The AIPP, though, is huge for them. It's deferred compensation that can last up to 20 years. Yearly payments under it were typically about 5% of an agent's previous year's production earnings. The company had billed that as a retirement program for agents because they can't sell their client list, as other companies often allow their agents to do. Agents say they signed a contract years ago. with company promises in mind, promises of a lifetime contract, a deal that turns out to be changeable. Here's a quote. We've been told for years the company valued the agent relationship. They always talk about this trust relationship, and that trust relationship has been broken by them. Agents are saying ending AIPP is, quote, grimy and dirty, and that State Farm sold them a false bill of goods.
Charlie Schlinker with that story. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be with us again next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.